And tonight on Extension 720, we venture far into human history, into the history of civilization, examining what it is arguably conceivable might be classed as the first great civilization in human history, namely the civilization of Egypt, though you could also put in a claim for Sumeria and Babylon. My guests are Jim Phillips and Emily Teeter. Jim Phillips has been on this program rather often. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and he's adjunct curator of anthropology at the Field Museum, where at the moment the new Tut exposition is fully displayed, and he has had a major role in helping put it together for the Chicago Stay. Our other guest is Emily Teeter, who is curator of Egyptian and Nubian Antiquities at the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. She's also president of the American Research in Egypt's Chicago chapter. Let us focus indirectly on King Tutankhamun. You know, Emily, I saw him, or rather saw that wonderful face mask, at, I guess it was the Art Institute of Chicago, someplace in the 1970s, didn't it?
It was 77. It was actually at the Field Museum.
Oh, was it
the
Field?
Yes, yeah. In 1977, the last big tour of
so it's come back
the United States.
Come back home to the Field.
That's right.
It's a dazzling piece.
It's a spectacular piece. It is not in this show, because that doesn't travel anymore. But there are pieces in this show that are as spectacular as that. In fact, this show actually has a little sort of more breadth than the 1977 show did.
And it extends, I gather, Jim Phillips, to more than the reign of Tutankhamun, which lasted, after all, only for 10 years.
Yes, what we really wanted to do and make it different from the 1977 exhibit was to actually put it in a different context, that is, the context of the role of a king in Egypt and the religious role, the political role, etc., and bring in the relatives of Tut. In fact, 50 objects in the exhibit are from Tut, but 70 come from his relatives, his ancestors.
His immediate ancestor, though it's confused as to whether he was the father or grandfather or what exactly, was Ikhnaten, who may well be properly designated as the first major monotheist in the history of the world.
Well, there's always a question when we look at Egyptian history on who actually is the parent of whom, and Ikhnaten is the putative parent of Tut. We don't know for certain, but most likely that's the case. The idea that Ikhnaten was a revolutionary and formed a new religion and revolutionized Egyptian religion is something I think that Emily could speak to more than I. But there's a real question of that his worship of the solar disk, the Aten, actually represents a monotheistic ideal.
Emily, does it? Is that really
most Egyptologists...
early monotheism?
Most Egyptologists would reject the idea that Akhenaten was actually a monotheist. If you look at it in sort of overall terms, you could say, yes, he elevated one god above the others and suppressed the other deities, which might be called a monotheism. But in fact, it wasn't, because the other deities were, in fact, still worshipped in other contexts. And what the movement actually looks like is not so much a monotheism, but sort of a power grab by the royal family, because not only is this solar deity, the Aten, elevated, but the status of the king himself and his queen, Nefertiti, the famous Nefertiti. So it becomes a triad. And so this has a lot of resonance also for archaizing, for going back to old kingdom models, 2,000 years before, to the time of the pyramids. And maybe Akhenaten trying to do something about sort of the character of kingship. But we tend to look at ancient Egypt through a sort of Judeo-Christian religious filter. And so we look at this and we tend to think it's monotheism, when in fact it was probably something quite different.
I suppose my understanding of it is corrupted by Hollywood. I do remember a film, though I don't remember its title, but Akhenaten...
The Egyptian, wasn't it?
No, I think not. That's the one about the physician, isn't it?
Right, Sinaway.
This is different.
Right, yeah.
This is, Ikhnaten is played by some British actor, Michael somebody, who for a while was the husband of Elizabeth Taylor. And Nefertiti is played quite appropriately by the beautiful Jean Tierney.
Oh, lovely.
And
yes.
He, Ikhnaten, in this, is seized of this great religious éclairissement. Suddenly,
yes.
he's had the deep mystical knowledge that God is represented by the disc and all else is profane, and he turns over all of Egypt to pursue and to establish this pure form of worship.
You have to be careful about what you see in movies.
Yeah, I know.
but you know what's interesting, if you think about it? I mean, Akhenaten was king for, what, 17 years, was mm-hmm. it, approximately? And you have another 9 or 10 for Tut. I mean, you've got somewhere, what is it, 17 and 9, you've got 20-some years of this, quote, revolution. I mean, it perhaps went on a little longer, and perhaps it was precipitated a little earlier, but in fact, you're only speaking of somewhere 25 or so years of this, quote, monotheistic revolution. I mean, I happen to agree absolutely with Emily about the ideal that it's not monotheism at all.
Well, actually, Tutankhamun is to Akhenaten as, say, Bloody Mary was to Henry VIII. That is, he, just as Bloody Mary, restores the old religion.
There's some very interesting new research that's been coming out, because as we know, about the year, Tutankhamun's on the throne about 10 years. In about year 5, he restores the old religion. And we used to assume that it was just a cut and dried thing, mm-hmm. that he's born into the so-called monotheistic Atenist religion, and then he restores the old polytheistic religion. But we're seeing records that there are actually Aten temples that are functioning well into Dynasty 19, about 60 years later, 70 years later. And so there's a much longer transition period and more sort of tolerance than what we assume there was.
That's the way the world really works, I think.
Ideally.
Yeah. To look at Egyptian civilization, where do you make a beginning? I know that officially one conceives Egyptian civilization as beginning at around 3500 BC, because that's when the communities along the Nile were somehow pulled together and unified. But there have been settlement along the Nile for some 5,000 or 6,000 years earlier.
Well, there were settlements. I've worked along the Nile for many, many years. There was in the prehistoric realm. There were settlements along the Nile from approximately 100,000 or so years ago on the present Nile.
So Paleolithic and Neolithic.
Paleolithic, Neolithic were there, but I would say, and probably differently than most people would, that the ideal of Egyptian civilization began when the introduction of wheat and barley occurred somewhere around 5,000 BC, during the beginning of what we would call the pre-dynastic period. And around that time, and within 2,000 years, is when we get the unification of Egypt around 3,000.
How does wheat and barley do the trick?
Cereal grasses are the essence of all civilizations. All. That means Chinese or Indian or Inca or
I love
whatever.
That for a strong statement. Cereal grasses are the essence of all civilizations.
Sure, and
explain the meaning of that.
Okay, cereal grasses are in the wild. You have wild rice, you have wild millet, sorghums, wheat, barley, maize. All of those are cereal grasses. And without them, we would not be here today. And I mean that as strongly as I could phrase that term. Cereal grasses were those kinds of cereal grasses which produce enormous crops, both in the wild and, of course, once they were cultivated. The cultivated ones were introduced to Egypt from the Levant, which is where the natural habitat was, approximately 5,000 or so B.C. And with that, the population of Egypt shifted, its orientation, subsistence orientation. They were hunters and gatherers before, up until around 5,000 or 5,500
so
BC.
So agriculture begins with those.
In other words, agriculture.
Cereal
yes,
grasses.
And I mean that kind of agriculture.
Yeah.
There's agriculture with other kinds of crops, but specifically cereal grasses.
But agriculture makes for stable settlement.
Yes, definitely. And in Egypt, we begin to find settlements that are radically different around 5,000 or so B.C. I mean, we find sites near the Delta, in the Delta, Umari, Adi. We have sites to the south, Hierakonpolis, places like that near Idfu, where we begin to get towns. Towns occur directly as a result of the introduction of these cereal grasses.
A little bit of elementary social theory. Durkheim says that you don't get civilization until you produce a class of people who don't have to do the hunting or the gathering or, for that matter, the farming. That there's enough surplus food produced so that other trades can develop, other social roles can get elaborated, and the priestly role emerges and government emerges and hierarchies emerge when we are living with surplus. Does that make sense to account for Egypt?
It seems to fit the Egyptian model quite well.
Mm-hmm. So what began to shape up around 3500 or 3000 BC?
Well, about that time, we have signs of a definite centralized kingship, iconography of kingship, very strong traditions of kingship, and a tremendous bureaucracy. From the very earliest period, the Egyptians show this really, really complex bureaucracy. I mean, if you think Washington, D.C. now is like tough, you know, go back to the old kingdom of Egypt. And so there were a lot of people who were freed from working in the fields. We see a lot of social stratification. We see a lot of crafts professions. And all of this has to do with, as Jim was talking about, a huge crop of grain. And in Egypt, throughout its history, grain was really the medium of exchange, the means rather than coinage. And so this is particularly clearly evidenced in Egypt. And so a lot of grain, fewer people work on the fields, more people do things like become priests, craftsmen, bureaucrats.
One of the great mysteries about civilizations is why do they develop, or how do they develop their distinctive styles, even the distinctive way in which they look, the way they dress, the kind of art they do, the kind of ceremonials they elaborate, the kind of buildings they erect. Why did Egypt, or how did Egypt, take the Egyptian turn rather than the turn that we find in the valley between the Euphrates and
Well, there's a basic. First of all, I'd like to make a little correction. Mesopotamian civilization was earlier than Egyptian civilization.
I know it was. There are those who argue that really high civilization was the attainment of the Egyptians.
I think it's Mesopotamia.
It's kind of a
toss up.
Yeah.
All right, 3500. You know, EB time, and it'd be relatively the same.
We've got city culture in Sumer by the 5000 BC, don't we?
Well, we have Ubaid and we have Hala. We have towns, yeah. Right? And towns develop, generally speaking, after this domestication of these particular crops in the Near East, which includes both the Tigris-Euphrates and the Levant, and in this instance, for the sake of our conversation, northeast Africa, that is Egypt of the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
But each one has a distinct flavor, and it's true. They each have a distinct flavor. As an example, building. In Mesopotamia, they built out of mud brick. Why? Because that's what they had. They had a lot of clay. In Egypt, they built out of stone. Why? Because they had lots of stone, literally. And the area between the cliffs, where, in other words, the floodplain of the river, was used specifically for, of course, towns and agriculture, and irrigated agriculture, which is the essence here.
But stone is much harder to work and requires a vast amount of greater effort, I should think, and therefore these people are willing to suffer through their long lives putting up some of the great temples, and for that matter, ultimately, putting up those pyramids.
I think, if I might say, Emily, before you get on, the Egyptians craftsmen, as Emily had suggested earlier, I mean, from day one, were superb in all materials, whether it was stone, whether it was precious stone, whether it was metal. Just as Emily suggested, the craft specialization in Egypt was way, way beyond most other civilizations from day one. And this bureaucratic element and this hierarchy, the social stratification she was referring to, clearly allowed for these relatively these specialists to come both from outside and from inside to develop crafts which were unequaled in the Mediterranean world.
Well, and this has to do with, as we were talking about, with the wealth of the country and with sedentary, with crops, because what happens is you end up with people who have more money than other people. Part of these are the bureaucrats, and so then they also feed this whole idea of craftsmen, because they commission crafts from this whole strain of craftsmen.
They are the patrons.
Yeah. And so from very early on, we have texts from the time of the pyramids that talk about the craft shops that are attached to the palace. There's one famous text that talks about a man who the king grants him some false doors, and the king himself comes to the craft shop and looks at it and, you know, admires the work each day. And so there was a tremendous appreciation in Egypt of craft and aesthetic and building. You were mentioning what makes Egypt so distinctive in the crafts, and it really boils down to the fact that the Egyptians were very keen observers of their environment. The Egyptians were very attuned to the area of the Nile Valley where they lived. So if you look at the temples, all the architectural elements are drawn from nature. They're big plant elements. The hieroglyphs are all plants and animals and things around them. And so these people are very It's very distinctive because it reflects their environment.
Is there much contact between Egypt and other civilizations early on? I know later on, of course, there is. But
yes, there is. I mean,
even say in 2500 BC.
In 2500 BC, I mean, even in around that time in the sixth dynasty, we know that the Egyptians were up at a place called Pepi's Nose. It's either up in Beirut or Haifa. We know that Egyptian, even in Old Kingdom, just the beginning of the Old Kingdom, 3000 or so BC, were in Sinai, all along the coast, and they were also in what is today the Negev. With settlements and civilizations, and we have ovens that they were baking bread in. They had resident traders, as a matter of fact, rather than conquerors.
We know this sort of thing from the kind of work that people like you do as archaeologists,
yes,
who go digging and finding artifacts, mm-hmm, through which you can track this pre-literate history.
Yes, of course.
But this is not pre-literate.
No, this
There's
is definitely
lots of written records.
By written
period.
Records by then, by 25.
Lots, three, oh, yeah. I mean, the period that I normally work in, no. I mean, there aren't
but
any.
But the period you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, definitely.
Biblos and
speaking of literacy, we are not going to print the news. We're going to hear the news in just a moment as we go to the newsroom. And I believe that will be given to us by Rob Hart. And we return to Jim Phillips, professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois Chicago, adjunct curator of anthropology at the Field Museum, where he was much involved with the now mounted Tut exposition, and Emily Teeter, curator of Egyptian and Nubian antiquities at the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago. And during the brief 90-second newscast, I asked Emily to write my name in hieroglyphs, and you've done that for me. So hieroglyphics, of course, at this late stage of development, is actually a phonetic language or a phonetic alphabet, is it?
From the very beginning, it's phonetic, and it's a very important aspect of the language. From the very, very get-go, from our first inscriptions about 3100 BC, it is always phonetic.
But when I look at this, because you've written my name below it, and there are six hieroglyphs and six letters in the name, first name Milton, the N looks like a man walking.
The last sign is actually determinative, which means that it is a man named Milton and not a thing named a Milton.
Oh. But the others are phonemic, are they?
Yes, because in the Egyptian language there are alphabetic signs, in other words, signs that have one sign that stands for one phoneme.
Yeah.
Like an M or an N or a T.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that sets Egyptian off from other languages is it gets very complicated because there are biliterals. One sign that stands for two phonemes, like an M and an N, or three, like an N, F, R together. Signs that have no phonetic value, signs that have phonetic value sometime, and no and not elsewhere. So it's
but these phonemic signs originated as pictographs, do they not?
Exactly, exactly. They're all recognizable things from the Egyptian
M sound
environment.
As you've drawn it looks like an owl. Is that
it
the
is
owl?
An owl? Very good.
Yeah.
My handwriting's terrible, but you could recognize it.
How did M come to be owl? Rather, how did owl come to be M?
We don't know. We don't know. And this is a very common misconception about the Egyptian language, is that it starts off, but it does start off being pictographic, but very early on, the connection between what the sound looks like and its use is broken, because very early on, they start transferring, they use the sign only for its phonetic value,
yeah,
and it has nothing to do with what the sign looks like. And so like Hor Apollo and other, the Neoplatonists and others, assumed that you could read, that hieroglyphs were allegorical, that the rabbit meant, you know, to be awake because a rabbit never sleeps, when in fact it's just the phoneme WN.
They had hieroglyphic texts, but they didn't know how to read them.
Well,
until the discovery of and the deciphering of the Rosetta Stone, is that right?
Correct, in 1822 when Jean-François Champollion.
Yeah. I will never forget the wonderful afternoon when I, as a sort of a callow postdoctoral type around London, went to the British Museum. It took a left turn at the entrance and walked down that hall, and suddenly there was the Rosetta Stone. I knew of its existence. I didn't know that it was on view to the public at the British Museum.
And in London, that's the point, not in France.
And in those days, it was just there.
Yes.
There wasn't a case over it.
It now is.
Look,
it's a little bit more difficult.
Now it's behind.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very protected.
I touched it. Yes, I touched it.
Yeah.
I was just there in March. My wife and I were excavating in Sinai, and I was just there, and there were you could hardly get to it, of course, with all the people. It's like going to see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre.
Well, on those same days, you could, in another part of London, you could walk down Downing Street and try to knock on the door at number 10 if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what does one learn from, let's explain to those who are listening what the Rosetta Stone was and how it provided an open sesame to Egyptian language.
The Rosetta Stone is a decree of one of the Ptolemaic rulers about 164 BC. And the content of it is sort of boring. It's about temple lands. But the thing that's important about it is it's a bilingual stone. It's written in three scripts, but two different languages. It's written in Greek and two forms of ancient Egyptian. One is the hieroglyphic script, which is familiar to most people, and the other is Demotic, which is a very cursive form of the language. It's the same, essentially the same language, but two different scripts. And so this was very important because Champollion and others could read Coptic, could read Greek. And so by matching up, repeating groups of signs and words, he was able to tease out phonemes and make sense out of it. It was a laborious process.
Champollion, was he along on Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, or did he just work on it in Paris when Napoleon brought it back?
He worked on prints of the Rosetta Stone when it came back.
Yeah, it was a great discovery, wasn't it?
Tremendous discovery.
And without it, we would know much less about the history of Egypt, I presume.
Well, there were other bilingual inscriptions. The Rosetta Stone was. Champollion was working on the Rosetta Stone at a fortuitous time. The other thing that's important to think about is this was the time of the Napoleonic expedition, as you said, and Napoleon's savants came back with a lot of examples of hieroglyphic texts, which gave Champollion more material to work on. Because if you only have two things to work on, you're not going to get very far. But if you have 60 examples of hieroglyphic script, you have a much better chance of cracking the code. And so Champollion had the Rosetta Stone at the right time. There was another very important bilingual inscription also that helped with this.
Now then, some commercials are impending, and after that, I think we go to the Field Museum, and we walk around and examine this great exhibit that is now on view there. We return to Jim Phillips and Emily Teeter and to the Pharaoh Tutankhamun directly after this. So let's go to the museum. And Jim Phillips, you've been involved in mounting that show for us, though it's running around the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be four venues in the United States, and after it, Philadelphia is the next venue after January.
When did it open here?
It opened on May 26th, and it will go on until the 1st of January 2007.
Uh-huh. So we've got a while. We can all go see it.
We do, and I
have not yet been there. Maggie, our producer, has been, but I've not yet been to it.
Well, please come.
Well,
I'll be happy to show you through.
I certainly intend to. But what would I see?
What you would see is our 11 galleries arranged chronologically. And the first gallery deals with, if you don't mind me going through the galleries
quickly.
The first gallery deals with the chronology of Tut's reign and his ancestors and objects from the tombs of his relatives, such as Amenhotep II, Amenhotep III, his grandfather, his great-grandmother, people like that. Then the second gallery is an emulation of the temple at Luxor, where you go through an area with columns with friezes on either side. And there are three objects in that particular room speaking about Egyptian religion. And the third room is a room that's devoted specifically to the great-grandmother of Tut, a woman named Tuya, who was buried in the Valley of the Kings with her husband, and by the grandfather of Tut, Amenhotep III. And that room is spectacular, in my opinion, in terms of the objects there. And we have an emulation of the Book of the Dead, which is above it. And then we move on to the next room, which deals with Akhenaten. It's a very small room. And then there are three rooms with objects directly from the tomb of Tut, some of which he had in real life, many of which were manufactured for the burial. And then we have an emulation of the sarcophagus room with a Burton photograph on the side, which is a very interesting technological feat. We could talk about it later. And the last room, which I think is a wonderful room, is a room designed by National Geographic and ourselves and AEI, the company, dealing with the CAT scan, the recent CAT scan that was done, the x-rays of the mummies,
yes,
and a variety of faces of Tut that are found in the tombs.
I was reading something about that just today. It was hypothesized many years ago that maybe Tut had been killed, that maybe there was a hole in the back of his head indicating a blow which laid him low. But I gather from these more recent MRI studies that hypothesis has been ruled out.
Right. I mean, in the 1978 x-ray, they noticed this hole that you were referring to, and it was then bandied about that he had been murdered.
Yeah.
And the CAT scan indicates that, of course, that no, he hadn't been murdered, but this is part of the mummification process that was done in the 18th dynasty.
And what I read today, though I don't know whether this is authenticated or just somebody's speculation, is that the evidence now points to his having got a wound in his knee or in his leg while possibly falling off a chariot and developing gangrene and dying within a few days of that wound.
Well, it's certainly not clear.
As a young man of 18 or 19.
There was certainly some reason he died prematurely. The leg is very badly fractured. Again, there are signs of trauma, but how you connect the dots between the trauma,
sure,
and the death is unclear.
All right, I agree. We don't know how he died.
Yeah.
He did break his leg. Whether he fell out of a chariot while he was hunting, whether he tripped down the stairs, we haven't the foggiest idea. But he certainly had a
How does somebody come to the very particular hypothesis of gangrene setting in? I don't know.
Well, just the idea. It's funny.
That's how a broken leg.
If you listen to the video and the discussion in that room,
yeah,
that we have. Zahi Awas, the Director General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, believes that he firmly believes that he died of an infection from this broken leg. So based on that, some people may say, oh, well, gee, what's the infection? Maybe it's gangrene.
I mean,
but it was a recent break. It wasn't a break that happened a year before. It happened relatively probably a month, within a month of his death.
What do we know about his reign? What do we know about the kind of pharaoh he was? For that matter, was the pharaonic position one of really high power, or was it more symbolic by then?
It's a good question, because the pharaoh has such prominence in iconography and
yeah,
in texts, and I mean, he's the ruler of the country. But what he actually meant on a day-to-day basis is a little more complicated to suss out, because Egypt had such a strong bureaucracy and such an enduring bureaucracy. We know that there are bureaucrats that would hold their positions through a whole series of different kings. And so the stability in the government really came from the bureaucrats, not so much from the king. And so we don't really know how much power the kings had. In theory, everything comes from the king. They make the laws, everything comes from them. But how that really plays out on a day-to-day basis, we simply don't know. The king had various advisors, but it's like looking at an organizational chart, and then from that trying to figure out how it works in the office on a day-to-day basis. We don't know.
It's interesting to place him in universal history. Tutankhamun reigns from 1332 to 1323 B.C. That's about 300 years before King David in Jerusalem, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. Yes.
And yet this is
what
a
would you like?
Show.
What would you like from that?
But this is called his period is called the New Kingdom.
Yes,
it's the last of three major periods of kingdoms in the history of Egypt.
Yes, I mean, it begins with what we call the Old Kingdom, which lasts from about 3,000 or so B.C. To about 2,300 or so. And then we have what's called the first intermediate period. I'd like to discuss, and I think Emily would too, what these intermediate periods actually mean. Then we have a Middle Kingdom from about 2,100 or so to 1,700 or 1,800, during the time of Hammurabi, in other words. And then we have the second intermediate. Then we have the New Kingdom, which begins begins around 1550 or so B.C., ending somewhere around 1070 or so, during, in other words, the time that you would be referring to, either Saul or David.
Why are the intermediate periods of special interest?
It's interesting why they're called intermediate periods in the first place. I mean, because what they represent is a disintegration of Egyptian society in some ways.
A time of collapse and crisis and so on.
Yes, yeah. And the question is why those collapses occurred. I know one of my old professors, a man named Carl Butzer, who was both a geographer and at the University of Chicago, geographer and an anthropologist, once wrote an article about cycles of civilization, and his idea, using Spengler's idea, his idea was that every time that there were a series of low floods, in other words, again, it was the agriculture in Nile, every time there was a series of low floods, we begin to, a long period of low floods, we begin to find the disintegration of Egyptian society. In other words, there was a direct correlation between low floods and disintegration. But also, of course, there are other factors that go into it, such as in the second intermediate period, first intermediate period, eventually by the end of it, we have an invasion of Egypt, which Emily can talk about, I'm sure.
Well, first of all, I think it's also important to point out that the Egyptians themselves did not recognize Old, Middle,
right.
and New Kingdoms.
Right.
Oh, of course not.
This is an imposition of scholars. This is a modern invention. The Egyptians viewed their history as one unbroken line of kings from the time of the immortal, the Biti kings, the legendary kings.
Mm-hmm.
The invasion of Egypt, there was one major invasion in the after second intermediate period, a group called the Hyksos in the area of Palestine. And this was very odd for the Egyptians, because although they viewed their history as one unbroken line of kings, this is something they had trouble with, because in fact there was a breaking of the history, although there were stronger kings in the southern part of the country. They were shoved down to the south by these invaders that came into the north. And so this was a period that was viewed with great horror by the Egyptians. And even the first intermediate period, which is a period of just decentralization and local governments, both of these periods were recognized by the Egyptians themselves as being odd. And they show up in literary texts as paradigms for misery and for you know, unhappiness and bad times.
What evidence do we have beyond or outside of the Old Testament of the residents in Egypt, the slavery in Egypt, of that people who became the Jews?
None.
Zero.
Absolutely none.
None. Zero.
Zero. What we do have, however, are records from one of the sons of Ramses II, Merenepta, who discusses the conquering of the, it's not Beit David, but the conquering of the Israelites.
It's actually, they call themselves Israel.
Israel.
It's the first
conquering
first
of Israel. It's the first
Israel
reference to Israel.
At what?
It's about 1220 or so.
Yeah. And
assuming then that they were taken into slavery.
No, assuming
after
there was a
conquest?
Country called, there was a place called Israel in Palestine that had just been conquered. Slavery was not mentioned in this.
And it's because even if one tries to look for evidence of the Exodus, which there is no evidence in the Egyptian records, and it's very difficult to figure out how that can work. Even after a period that might be equated with the Exodus, and if there was a historic Exodus, people would put it Ramses II, Merenptah, something like that. But we have many records later of people with Semitic names being in Egypt. And so there were a lot of people.
Well, they hang on.
Yeah.
Some of them do.
Yeah.
They don't all follow Moses.
No, apparently
not. No, we even have, remember, at the Elephantine, we have a Jewish army during Persian period times at Elephantine Island, writing in Aramaic, as a matter of fact, a whole series of tablets. So,
well, what do scholars like you reconstruct, or how do they theorize about what reality lies behind what we get in Genesis, Joseph in Egypt, etc., the slavery, the Exodus?
Well, first of all, they didn't build the pyramids, I could tell you that.
Yep.
First, if there were to be an Exodus, and if there was to be this ideal of Israel in Egypt, etc., it had to be during New Kingdom times. It wasn't during the pyramid times, which is 2,000 years earlier, 1,500 years earlier. One of the questions that one might ask is, and Emily just referred to it in some way, were there any Semites in Egypt? There were always Semites in Egypt, as a matter of fact, because Egypt was in Palestine, in that area, or Canaan, where there were people who were of Semitic origin.
I mean,
that
Egypt
is
extended
speaking
to the east.
I mean, and always in the Delta, where Menfred Bitek and other people are working. And now there were clearly people, Bedouin, the equivalent of Bedouin, coming in constantly into the Delta. One of the things, going back to what I was referring to earlier, agriculture and the importance of cereal agriculture, in effect, Egypt became the breadbasket of the Mediterranean world. I mean, they, because of the nature of the Nile itself, the flooding of the Nile, which precipitates silt, and as the water retreats, the silt is deposited so they could triple crop, actually.
Still, I want to persist. Only last night we were talking about the search for the historical Jesus. I ask you to engage for a moment in the search for the historical Moses. Was there an Exodus? Were there people who became the Jewish people in Egypt? Did they get out of Egypt? Were they led by some figure called Moses?
As an Egyptologist, I deal intensively with primary sources,
with
the inscriptions on temples, on tombs.
And you find nothing there?
There is nothing. And if you approach things from that viewpoint, you have to go with the available evidence. And so it is, Excellencio, there is no evidence from the Egyptian sources. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but you have to search for some way that you can sort of make these sources agree in that either there was an exodus which the Egyptians didn't record, which seems a little odd, or perhaps the exodus was a gradual migration which the Egyptians would not take note of, which was canonized in the Bible as being a major migration.
Is that one you would settle for?
I don't really settle for anything, because I will look at it from the Egyptian perspective, and I just have to say, from my information, there's nothing, and I leave it to others that might have information from another direction.
I've worked in Sinai for 40 years. Think of it, that number. But I've worked in Sinai for 40 years, and not digging in Sinai for 40 years. And I'll just give you a little vignette. We all know of about a place called Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments. Well, the place which is called Mount Sinai today, of course, is a place where Helena, the mother of Constantine, assigned it, because there are other places which where both Israeli archaeologists and other people believe are Mount Sinai, like Jebel Halal in northern Sinai, or somebody believes it's in Saudi Arabia, because Jethro, that is the father of Zipporah, who was the wife of Moses, is from Saudi Arabia. I mean, you can go on and on and on. I have seen, there are some very early Israelite places in Sinai. A colleague of mine and named James Hoffmeyer from Trinity University is working specifically on that project we can talk about in a little while.
We need to pursue this. We've got some commercials coming. That's why I've just signaled you. Hold that thought. Hold that information. We'll return to the quest for the historical Moses and the historical Exodus right after we pause for these words. With a quick reintroduction of our guests, we are talking about ancient Egypt, and the immediate occasion for that is the Tutankhamun exhibit at the Field Museum. And Jim Phillips, one of our guests, is the curator of that show and of anthropology at the Field Museum. He's adjunct curator. He's also, of course, professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois Chicago and a veteran in archaeological research throughout the Middle East. Emily Teeter is curator of the Grimshaw Egyptian Gallery at the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago and is president of the American Research in Egypt's Chicago chapter. What is that?
The American Research Center is the group that coordinates all American work in Egypt, whether it's pharaonic, Coptic, modern, medieval. And there are a number of local chapters that are devoted to doing public programming, and because there are a lot of people all over the United States that are very interested in Egypt. So it's an interest group. It's for laymen, for people who are interested. We bring in speakers, specialized speakers, to give talks on different aspects of Egypt.
Have you brought Jim Phillips in?
Not yet.
I was just
Not
thinking
yet.
Of that, Emily. Gee,
yeah. But there's time.
Now, Jim Phillips, back to the quest for the historic Moses.
There's You're looking evidence. For Moses. And so, truthfully, now, in all the years that I've worked in, and anybody working in Sinai who has a grain of sense is always looking for signs, shall we say. Remember, the first archaeology in Sinai was done by a man named Palmer in the 1870s, who was a rector, who was a British reverent. Much of the earliest work in Sinai was done by people looking specifically for the Exodus. And I don't know what they were looking for, to be frank with you. What were they going to find? Well, they could find some spaces where the children of Israel could be standing when Moses was coming down from a mountain. And in fact, in front of what is today called Har Sinai or Jebel Musa in Arabic, Mount Sinai, there was a huge plain called the Raha Plain where you could fit lots of people. And that was in the 1850s on. I mean, people were saying that this was the place where it happened. Today, if you go there, I have to tell you, it's full of hotels and not the nicest place you would want to be. When I first started working there, it was completely empty, and it did look very interesting. But there's no direct evidence that I know of, or anyone could imagine at the moment, that indicates there was a group of people leaving Egypt, going across what was called Yam Suf in the Old Testament, Yam Suf, which doesn't mean Red Sea, but means Reed Sea, which is the area where near Suez, etc., going across, traveling 40 years and winding up somewhere in Israel. No, there, what is today Israel? No, there's no direct evidence.
We were talking about the origins of Egyptian civilization. We know a great deal, but still there are ambiguities and there are scholarly debates. We know a good deal more, don't we, about the more or less decline of or the end of Egyptian civilization. We can blame it all on the Romans, can't we?
Well,
and the date is 30 BC.
30 BC is the year that Cleopatra lost to Octavian. And so that's the year that Egypt, which was under the Ptolemaic rulers who were of Macedonian extraction, then becomes a province of Rome. Well, you could actually make a case that it wasn't really a decline, because Egypt is such an odd case, because through all the different periods, through the Pharaonic period and through the Greek rule period and then through the Roman period, Egypt actually stays very intact. It keeps most of its beliefs. The geographic borders never change. It's not as if big sections of the country get lopped off as they do in other countries. And so it's almost more like a transformation of the society. It's a very odd thing to try to trace, because the Egyptian culture does not just evaporate. It doesn't die with the influx of the Romans. The Romans, of course, were very generally, well, to a certain extent, tolerant of other people's culture, as long as you agreed to worship the Roman emperor. But again, when people say, at what point did the Egyptian civilization die or vanish, it's very hard to put your finger on
it. Well, as a matter of fact, putting the Romans aside for the moment, what about the Greeks 300 years earlier? Because as you pointed out, Cleopatra was the last of the Ptolemaic dynasty. The first was Ptolemy, one of Alexander the Great's generals. When Alexander dies, he sort of splits his empire between three or four of his generals, and he gives northeast Africa to his general Ptolemy.
No, you can go further back in time. I mean, one of the interesting things about Egypt, and to follow and even expand a little bit on what Emily was saying, Egypt was occupied from approximately 730 or 740 BC until 1952 AD. Literally, first by the Nubians, then by the Assyrians, then by the Persians, then by the Greeks, then by the Romans, then eventually by the Islam, then by the Ottomans, et cetera.
And then by the British.
And they maintain, and this is, I think, an important point, Egyptians have always maintained their culture. Never have they lost
their
culture.
Well, surely their religion declined and
their
became
religion was taken over
Muslim,
by Christianity. First it was Christianity, remember. I mean, Egypt was one of the first countries to become Christian.
And the remnant of that is Coptic Christianity.
Absolutely.
Today.
And in fact, most Copts will tell you they are the ancient Egyptians, as opposed to the Muslims, who, of course, these people, in other words, the Copts, hadn't converted, all right, and therefore hadn't converted to
Islam.
What's
the relation between the Coptic language and Egyptian as the ancient Egyptians spoke it?
It's the same. It's essentially the same language. It's the last remnant. It's the Coptic is still used as the liturgical language in the Coptic Church, and although the vocalization is probably quite different, it's the same language. It's you know, very much changed. For example, if you compare Chaucerian English and modern English, that sort of thing, but Coptic is the ancient Egyptian language. You could even say that the ancient Egyptian language is maybe the language that's been spoken longest continuously of any language in the world, if you count Coptic as ancient
Egyptian.
Can either
of you do a passage or two in Coptic at the
Not
moment?
Not moi.
No, it's
No?
not.
I'd love to hear the sound of it.
I
Don't think it's from either of us, and you'll hear
no.
it. All
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
That's all right. We are going to pause in just a moment for the usual reasons, but first it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines, and as ever, the number, of course, is 591-7200. If anybody out there can pronounce a few lines of poetry in Coptic, or for that matter of liturgy, do give us a call. There are people in town, undoubtedly, who can do that. 591-7200 is the number. If you've got a question to raise or a thought to share, by all means, call quickly. 591-7200 for everything you ever wanted to ask about ancient Egyptian civilization. And if you are listening to us up very early in Cairo and you want to share your knowledge with us, you can get to us, of course, via email, the email being extension 720 at tribune.com. For all of our internet listeners around the world, we're always eager to hear from you, or even around this country. So do email us if you so choose, extension 720 at tribune.com, and by phone 591-7200. 591-7200, if you can get your hands on a phone, is how you reach us. And we go directly to the first caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question. This is regarding actually ancient Egypt. Hello?
We are here, sir.
Okay.
Be
No
competent
problem.
and proceed.
I was talking with one of my friends, and he had actually told me a piece of information that I didn't know if it was true or not. He had told me that Cleopatra was actually Greek, not Egyptian.
Well,
And I just
we just touched upon that a few minutes ago.
That's
She's
correct. She
descended
was a
from,
Macedonian Greek.
yeah. Though there may have been some Egyptian in there by then. This is about 7 or 8
I don't
generations.
think there was any Egyptian in the view,
No?
Emily.
The Ptolemies had this interesting habit of brother-sister marriages, primarily to maintain the purity of the Macedonian blood. So there wasn't very much intermarriage with the Egyptians and the Macedonians.
Is that when it starts? Only with the
Well,
Macedonian?
there are a few examples beforehand, but it's much more prevalent in the Ptolemies.
No, I mean, Emily's said it correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we see any dire effects genetically from all of that close inbreeding?
Well, one of the interesting things in going back to the Tut exhibit is that there are some peculiar features of the Tut dynasty, that is, physically. If you were to look at Akhenaten or you were to look at Nefertiti, they have elongated heads and and long chins, and the daughters of Nefertiti have elongated heads, and even Tut has an elongated head. And the question is it originally, the question was before they did any X-rays, was it an art style? Was it a genetic problem, et cetera? And another idea could be head molding, that is, as many groups of people do. So here in this particular area, if Tut was the son of Akhenaten and he married his half sister, who was the daughter of Nefertiti, then of course this is one of the examples going way back in time. And as Emily has suggested, it becomes much more a de facto kind of a thing in the Ptolemaic dynasties.
Our phone number, 591-7200, and I may properly inform you that we've got a number of lines now available. If you've been trying to reach us, we've cleared some lines, so do quickly try again. 591-7200. If you're calling long distance, of course, that's prefixed with 312, then 591-7200. If you want to reach us by email, that is extension 720 at tribune.com. And we go to the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. I had a question for you and your guest.
Yes, sir.
And that is concerning, I've been fortunate enough to see both of the Tut exhibits at the Fuseum. Where did the gold that was shown with all these pharaohs come from? Who were the Egyptian trading partners that they were able to secure this precious metal?
Interesting question. I remember from the first one that I saw back in 77, tremendously beautiful gold objects.
Gold, gold amongst a number of different raw materials were imported into Egypt. Specifically, gold comes from the 70 mines in Nubia to the south. But if you want, we can go into other kinds of things. Lapis comes from Afghanistan. Oils come from Crete. Silver, if they had it, came from Damascus. Copper from that area, Syria. Copper comes from Jordan and from the area of near Aqaba. But there is one little source of a greenish malachite-like copper in the eastern desert. The black eyes of that death mask that you were talking about that didn't show up, didn't arrive here this time, nor will it ever leave Egypt, is actually a kind of a meteorite glass that was found in the eastern, in the western desert of Egypt near the Libyan border. In the object that we have in the museum today, that is the coffinette, the little black eyes are actually obsidian, which comes from East Africa. So there was a number of, if not trading partners, areas from which the Egyptians were getting raw material to do their wonderful craftsmanship.
A lot of trade, all over the place.
Yeah.
Yes.
Does it extend as far as the Far Orient? Is there any evidence of some interaction with China?
Not that I know of before, certainly with India by the time of the Ptolemies.
I think about the farthest field is Bactria,
Yeah.
Where the lapis is being transshipped in.
Right, right. Bactria, which is, you know, near the Iranian Kazakhstan, that area border.
Sarah, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have heard from you, and we'll go directly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I had a question regarding the library at Alexandria. And I wanted to know if there was a list of books that were definitely known to have been housed there that were sort of unique copies and have now been lost to history.
It is commonly said or assumed that that is the case, that many of the great works of Greek antiquity that we don't have, but whose titles we have, would have been in the Library of Alexandria, which was burned by whom?
It was burned several times, and I don't remember the exact details. In the wars with Caesar, it was burned, but it, there were other destructions in the library. As for a shelf list, I'm not aware of one, but certainly, Milt, as you mentioned, we know of a lot of the great classics of learning that were from Alexandria, because so many of the scholars were there, but I simply don't know if there was.
We have the titles of plays by Aristophanes, by Euripides, but only the titles, and those plays are lost. It is assumed that they would have been on the shelf.
Well, just as we have
in the great library.
Just as we have material from Philo, you know, who is one of the people who mentions the Essenes, as a matter of fact, in terms of the Dead Sea Scroll. There were lots of manuscripts that were lost, burned, and lost that we have names of, but we do not have, just as Emily suggested, we certainly don't have a list.
How often does it happen that on an American talk show, on a commercial station, two nights in a row, the name of Philo Judaicus comes up? Because it came up last night.
Did it really?
Well, we were talking about the search for the historical Jesus.
Well, I mean, Philo was a very important person. He and Josephus are the two people that actually mentioned, if not exactly the scrolls, but it mentioned the people who were living in the desert of Qumran.
Of course, Philo is actually spending much of his life in Alexandria, is he not?
He is. He never was in Palestine. Now, or if he was, we don't know about it.
He's a Jew living in Alexandria.
Exactly.
In what period?
Around 30 or 40 A.D.
Yeah. And Alexandria had become a great polyglot, cosmopolitan.
It was a wonderful place, set up by the Ptolemies, actually. I mean, and Cleopatra's ancestors, as a matter of fact.
Sarah, thank you for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Nice to have heard from you. And I think we'll pause right now, take care of some commercials, and we shall return directly after this. And we return to Emily Teeter, curator of the Grimshaw Egyptian Gallery at the Oriental Institute on the campus of the University of Chicago, of course, and to Jim Phillips, professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and adjunct curator of anthropology at the Field Museum. And he, of course, exerted a large hand in the Tut show. What is its official title?
Tutankhamun and the Golden Age of the Pharaohs.
There we are, at the Field Museum. 591-7200 is our number. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm calling from Genoa, Illinois. I have a question. Did Akhenaten, in his monotheism, precede Yahweh and the Jewish monotheism?
There's a real question, if as Emily had suggested earlier, and I agreed with, that Akhenaten actually was a monotheist. But the first reference to Yahweh, or Jehovah, we would put it in English, I don't know. It's no earlier than 1100 B.C., and certainly Akhenaten was 300 years or 250 or so years earlier.
Yeah. Well, that suggests that monotheism first enters into human thought and gets serious consideration in Egypt.
Well, if indeed that is, it is a monotheistic system under Akhenaten.
Yeah. Well, what do you have to that sheds light on that question? What materials are available?
Well, we have a lot of material. We have written records. We don't have the equivalent of a Quran or a Bible, mm-hmm. but we do have a lot of texts. We have...
Isn't there a hymn to Aton?
There's a hymn to the Aton.
Supposedly written by Akhenaten?
Well, we don't really know, but it is closely associated with him.
Yeah.
And that is the one that, of course, is associated with the Psalms, has a lot of similarities to the Psalms, mm-hmm. depending on how you read it. We have a lot of other hymns, dedications to the Aten that it describe the sort of precepts of the philosophy. Many people actually believe it's a philosophy rather than a religion because it's in some ways sort of atheistic, because he's denying the gods in this whole thing, and so it's a very odd thing. I think it's really, we tend to call it monotheism mistakenly, because to us that's the closest paradigm we can come up with.
Our thanks to the caller. Here's an interesting email. In the light of popular fiction and films relating to searches for ancient, quote, artifacts, the lost ark and the Holy Grail, amongst others, is there any Egyptian, quote, missing artifact out there that researchers are aware likely exists but has yet to actually be found?
Oh,
only the one Zahawas wants.
Well, a good one would be Manetho's manuscript. Manetho was a Greek priest who wrote a history of Egypt that's missing.
Uh-huh.
We only have a few, you know, it's much later, but if we could find that, that would be a tremendous boon.
And in fact, the division into old, new, and intermediate periods comes from this manuscript. So
from Manetho?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was that burned up at the Library of Alexandria?
Je ne sais pas.
Could have been, I guess. Back to the phones, 591-7200. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Rosenberg.
Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if your panel would be able to answer a question. I'm a volunteer at Steele Museum, and I've always wondered how one museum, like the Cairo Museum, will have some of its very important artifacts on loan, or another museum, like the Field, will take them and mold a new exhibition around them. How does that whole process work out?
How does the process of loaning, well, let's say that a concept develops, a concept for a particular exhibit. It could be anything. It could be the Art Institute, the Oriental Institute, the Field Museum. Let's take the Field Museum, where you work and where I work. We have an idea, and then we start writing up precepts of it, looking at how we might arrange something. Once we have the concept, let's say life and death in Egypt, and then we would have to go out, if we don't have it in our own collection, we'd have to go to the Oriental Institute or the Brooklyn Museum or the Cairo Museum or in Germany, etc., where reside a number of Egyptian antiquities which would relate to this particular exhibit. Then the process of getting the loans is the real problem. Insurance, shipping, the idea of actually allowing us to have those things. I mean, it's a long process. Even with this particular exhibit, the Tut exhibit, it's at least 2.5 years from inception until today. Actually,
oh, really?
3 years. Yeah, sure.
Goodness. Now, I know the Americas in 2007 will be taking form soon. How long has that exhibit been
2 years.
Work?
2 years.
No, 2 years ago.
What exhibit is that?
We're redoing the Americas Hall expanding it at the Field Museum and the permanent exhibit. And therefore, mm-hmm. we're able to redesign the entire exhibit. It costs lots and lots of money, but the end result's going to be a magnificent exhibit of Native American objects.
Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Interesting contribution indeed. Now, here's an equally interesting email that's come in, a little bit longish, but well worth reading. Two comments slash questions, please. One, if all of the stones that went into the pyramids were quarried from the east bank of the Nile, not the west bank where the pyramids were built, why was that? All that effort to get them across the Nile, why? There was stone enough on the west bank, no pyramids on the east side, yet all of the stone had to come from that side, as I read it a couple of decades ago. That's question one. Question two, Herodotus was horrified by all of that wasted effort that went into the useless pyramids, effort that might have been building dams, aqueducts, roads, and irrigation ditches. Would you comment on this, please? Why should we today look with respect upon the pyramids as most of us seem to be taught we ought to? We do know that a few historians maintain that Herodotus never visited Egypt. Some of his students or associates did, however. What do your guests think about this scholarly split regarding whether or not Herodotus was in Egypt? More important, though, what about his criticism of the stupid slave-built pyramids? What's in them that we're supposed to admire?
Well, first of all, the stone for the pyramids, it was taken from the west bank of the Nile. The Giza group, the main parts of the stone were taken from the Giza plateau itself.
Which is West Bank. So he's wrong in his first...
He is wrong with that. Now, the Tura limestone, the casing, was taken from the East Bank, but that's a very small percentage of the stone.
Uh-huh.
The Egyptians would do a lot of work, but they were no dopes. You know, if they could reduce the amount of work, they would do it. So the stone is taken from very close to the building site. The second part of the question was, why should we admire the pyramids?
Well, Herodotus, he says... thinks that they are wasteful, and the effort could have been better used on building infrastructure. But he also raises the question of whether Herodotus ever actually visited Egypt.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the pyramids were very good for building infrastructure because they were a great centralizing part of the government, because it forced a lot of people to work for the government. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of people dependent on the government for your wages, it does very well for political control.
Sounds like the New Deal.
In fact, the a very good comparison. Pyramid building is very much like the New Deal. It was to put people to work on good projects, keep them under control. Now, whether Herodotus actually visited Egypt is a little bit more complicated. It's assumed that a lot of what he wrote is from Hecateus of Miletus, that it was picked up from his works. But I'm not quite sure. I don't know enough about Herodotus to really say yes or no definitively whether he was there or not. But Herodotus also, he had a problem with the pyramids. If you recall, his story was that the daughter of Menkaure, who built the smallest of the pyramid, as I recall, that she would prostitute herself, and that all of her lovers would have to bring a stone for the pyramid. So he had a problem with the pyramids.
One of the things in almost all, if not all, ancient civilizations is that part of the bureaucratic system was that everyone under a certain level in the hierarchy owed X amount of time to the state. That is what we call curvae labor. So it could be 10 days, it could be 20 days, it could be 30 days, but they had to work on public projects. It was the same in Mesopotamia, in Old Babylonia, in Assyria, even in Sumer. It was in Egypt also. It certainly was in China. That is, the people who did most of the buildings were paid, yes. And it's interesting, what were they paid with? As Zahiwas and Mark Lehner found out, beer.
Hmm.
They got a lot of beer, and they were beer
majors
and grain. Beer and grain, the essence of Egypt. Grain is, and then the product of it, one of the products is beer.
It's one way to keep the folks happy.
Indeed.
I think Herodotus was in Egypt. I've always enjoyed Herodotus's histories, which of course go back to 450 BC. It's basically a history of the Persian Wars. But here's a little bit of Herodotus on Egypt. I quote, "Concerning Egypt itself, I shall extend my remarks to a great length, because there is no country that possesses so many wonders, nor any that has such a number of works which defy description. Not only is the climate different from that of the rest of the world, and the rivers unlike any other rivers, but the people also, in most of their manners and customs, exactly reverse the common practice of mankind. The women attend the markets and trade, while the men sit at home at the loom. And here, while the rest of the world works the woof up the warp, the Egyptians work it down. The women likewise carry burdens upon their shoulders, while the men carry them upon their heads. They eat their food out of doors in the streets, but retire for private purposes to their houses. Meaning they've got bathrooms, I gather. Giving as a reason that what is unseemly but necessary ought to be done in secret, but what has nothing unseemly about it should be done openly. A woman cannot serve the priestly office either for God or for goddess, but men are priests to both. Some sons need not support their parents unless they choose, but daughters must, whether they choose or no. And he goes on and on with that catalog of the odd customs of the Egyptians.
Well, if you remember that Herodotus was Greek, and the Greeks were completely baffled by the Egyptians. When the Greeks got into Egypt, they were humbled by the antiquity of the civilization, and they basically didn't understand what the Egyptians were about. And so there was a huge amount of awe and also miscommunication and misunderstanding. For example, the Greeks could make heads or tails of the Egyptian religious system with all of the deities and the fluidity of the religious beliefs. And so they just assumed the Egyptians had some sort of esoteric knowledge.
But they borrow some Egyptian gods.
Well, Isis
certainly. In their mystery religions,
Isis,
particularly.
Yes. And in fact, that's where we get a misconception about Egyptian religion, because Egyptian religion was not laden with mysteries. And we tend to get that from the Greco-Roman tradition, where they adopted Isis and made
cult,
it. Yeah,
right.
The Isis cult.
And isn't it wonderful how some of this comes down through many layers of derivation to Masonic practice in the modern world?
Oh, yes.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not going to comment on the Masons.
Why not?
I don't know very much about them.
Well, I don't. I'm not a Mason, but you can read a good deal about them. There's a good deal of material on them.
Well, it goes back to the idea that people still have this sense of awe about the Egyptians, the antiquity, and also the idea that these people had knowledge that nobody else does, and hence the Masons with their quasi veneration for quasi-Egyptian ritual and iconography.
A last round of commercials coming, and then right back to the phones on 591-7200. And back to Jim Phillips and Emily Teeter and Tutankhamun. And back to you on the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure I was on. This is BJ.
It's not actually. It could be somebody who does a good imitation of you.
Okay. Well, they're doing a good one. I've been waiting so long, I almost thought I wasn't going to get on, but I wanted to comment. First of all, Dr. Rosenberg, thanks for another very interesting show.
Well, thank you for saying so.
And I've taken a master's in Middle Eastern archaeology, and my subspecialty was Egyptology, but it was many years ago at U of C, at the Oriental Institute. And I'm fascinated with the conversation, and also congratulations to the gentleman who's the curator of the new King Tut exhibit, which I took my sister and brother-in-law, who were visiting from Arizona, took them to see it last month, and it was just fantastic. Certainly not, you know, the impact of the first one, obviously, when we've never seen anything like that. But it was beautifully done, and if the Cairo Museum had $1 million lying around, they should give it to you and let you go there and do what you've done here for the Cairo Museum, which is a complete mess.
Actually, what they're doing is they're building a new museum. They've got a loan of $300 million from the Japanese government. They're building it near the Giza Plateau, which is a problem, actually, but they're building a huge museum where it'll be as technologically adept, supposedly, as ours.
That'll be amazing.
It will be amazing, it's true.
The one that's there now, I mean, they can't handle what they have now.
Well, that's because people are constantly digging.
Yeah, that's true, too. It just seemed to be disorganized. But in any case, my comment was the twist of fate. The caller that called quite a while ago and asked if it was really true that Cleopatra was not Egyptian brings just to mind, and I don't know because there's so much more research that's been done since I took my master's. The story was that Ptolemy had a half-brother. His father, King Philip of Macedonia, had a girlfriend. In addition to Alexander's mother, he had a girlfriend named Arsinoe. And Arsinoe had a kid named Ptolemy. And when they were on the campaign, it became clear that Ptolemy would become a rival once they got back to Macedonia, which they always believed they would do. So it was decided, Alexander thought it was best to give him his own country. And, you know, how would you like Egypt? That's a great, you know, country. You go and be the king of Egypt or whatever. And so he accidentally ended up being the first, you know, of his dynasty in Egypt for the next, you know, went on for, 300 and some years. And there were several Cleopatras, by the way, Cleopatra Helene and Cleopatra Celeste and blah, blah, blah. So it was not, the only time there was ever a Cleopatra, but she was the last of the line. And I just wonder if that research is still true, that he wasn't just a general in the army, but he was, in fact, Alexander's rival by being his half-brother, was rival for the throne of Macedonia. Is that still proven to be true?
I'm afraid I really don't know. I have not heard that before.
Nor have I. I mean, remember when Alexander died, what was it, 323, I think, or 321, mm-hmm. His kingdom was divided into what became the Seleucid kingdom, which was the area of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine, and Ptolemy. There was one other, if I remember correctly. Maybe not. No,
yep.
Those two. I've never heard that Ptolemy was a half-brother of Alexander.
You got that from a teaching assistant, too.
Okay, well, now I know. I wondered if there was more definitive research being done. Thank you for the comments and the interesting...
And we thank you, ma'am, for an interesting call, indeed.
Thanks.
And
bye-bye.
We'll go directly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi, my name is Scott. I'm calling from Highland, Indiana.
What if your name were George?
Well, I don't know.
All right.
I would ask this question about the historical Moses. Did the Egyptians ever typify in record keeping their defeats? In other words, if a pharaoh was defeated in a humiliated fashion, would they ever actually portray that?
That's it's a very good question. The Egyptians were the nature of Egyptian historical records is to make the Egyptians look good, and so. I can't recall if there are anything that just say we got beat. The best example is the Battle of Kadesh, which was clearly a draw, if not a minor defeat for the Egyptians, and it was written up as a glorious victory. And so I think what you're getting at here is perhaps the Exodus took place, but it was not recorded in Egyptian records because it was not a victory for the Egyptians. We simply don't know.
If I might ask one more question, looking for the historical Israelites, at what point in time does it enter into Middle Eastern record keeping where the Israelites were in the land in great force, similar to what we might recognize as being the biblical Israel?
Well, clearly, when Merneptah, the son of Ramses II, mentions the defeat of Israel in around 1220 BC, there clearly was an entity called Israel in the land of what today is Israel or Palestine, that area. That's first. A little later on, we have a reference to Beit David, that it's the house of David in the Dan inscription, which occurred somewhere around 1000 or so, 980, 1000 BC. So between 1220 and 1000 BC, it's pretty clear that that's the time period where they're at least the terminus, where we have an entity which is called Israel.
Well, you answered my question. Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call. And we proceed to another. Good evening. You are on the air.
Good evening, Mel. How are you doing?
Fine, sir. Go ahead.
I study Napoleon Bonaparte quite a bit. I got done reading a book by David Chandler, in which the quote says, "When Napoleon was in Egypt, I have opened the pyramids for all the world's glory to see, and I shall bring them back for the world to see." Was Napoleon actually interested in Egypt, or was he more of the European grave robber that happened in Egypt?
Very interesting question. What do we make of Napoleon's rape of Egypt?
Well, he was there for strategic reasons because of the British move into the area. It was part of the great game between the British and the French at that time, with rivalry for control over the passages through to India. And so I'm not aware that Napoleon was specifically motivated by the glory of Egypt's monuments. He was there because of political reasons, but when he got there, he was very, very impressed. And of course, he brought this whole group of savants, these scholars, with him, and to do the documentation of Egypt. And so it was a political move that was wrapped up with this sort of more altruistic humanism. Publishing and documenting the people, the geology, the geography, and the monuments.
Yeah, he brought, of course, people that worked, as Emily suggested, not just geographers and but zoologists and botanists and artists who could render these plants and animals in absolutely magnificent style. Come to the, by the way, come to the Field Museum Library, where we have some of the original documents from the Napoleonic, the drafting and drawing of tombs, of mummies in tombs, because they did unwrap mummies and draw them, in addition to the monuments of Egypt.
Do you think that it served more as a Bonaparte propaganda tool than actually any importance to...
You mean the rendering of Egyptian antiquities and Egyptian society? Remember, they got it, but it wasn't translated, as Emily was speaking about, till 1822, long after Napoleon was in power.
Our thanks to the caller. You know, that puts me in mind of yet another connection between this town and Egypt, which we really ought to talk about. Namely, Breasted, going way back from the University of Chicago, and the Oriental Institute, and the Egyptian operations from the Oriental Institute, which continue to this day, don't they?
That's right. James Henry Breasted, who was from Rockford, first American to receive a PhD in Egyptology, he founded the Oriental Institute in 1919. And under his tutelage, the University of Chicago became one of the great forces in Egypt. Since 1924, every year, aside from a couple years in World War II, we've had a field mission in Luxor, the epigraphic survey that is copying and
aren't they based in a place that they call Chicago House?
Chicago House,
in
yes.
Luxor, yeah.
Yes, it is. It's called
Wonderful
Chicago
place
House.
Too.
Yeah. And so the University of Chicago has, and Chicago has always had a very great presence in Egypt.
And what has their work been, most particularly? What epigraphic and archaeological work have they been doing?
Well, the epigraphic survey has been recording the reliefs and inscriptions, the decoration on temples and tombs. And this is very, very important because many of these structures are being rapidly eroded through rising water table and erosion. I mean, some of these things that you could see 20 years ago.
Some of them were destroyed by the building of the Aswan Dam, were they not?
Well, the Aswan Dam is only one feature. Increased cultivation is a bigger culprit as they do more irrigation. But it's just shocking. Walls that you could see the reliefs on 20 years ago are blank now. And so it's a real race against time. And the survey is one of the groups, it has the most exacting standards to do exact facsimile copies of this really important material. Because you might say, oh, it's just a picture on a wall, but these are historical documents. And then also from 1926, the University of Chicago had a large architectural crew who was studying, actually excavating and studying the monuments as well.
And, you know, Breasted also founded the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockefellers, of course, were the founders of the University of Chicago anyway in the 1870s or so, when Harper became president. Breasted was funded by the Rockefellers to found this museum of Palestinian antiquities in 1925 or so. So he was a Renaissance man anyway. I mean,
very much so.
Yeah.
You two are both inheritors of Breasted, so to speak. You're both trained at the University of Chicago,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was trained a little earlier than Emily, I went in a different direction, beginning in biblical archaeology and Egyptology, and moving back in time to where I normally work.
It's so many people in our field, a huge percentage of people are trained in Chicago, that Chicago has a very, very strong influence in ancient Near Eastern studies.
In 1 minute, what do the modern Egyptians make of their own history?
The modern Egyptians, up until, I would say, quite recently, till the mid-20th century, didn't really care very much about their antiquities, in the sense that they knew they were there, they were part of their lives, they were part of their culture, they were important, and at the same time, they were taken for granted. And not because of any direct negative element, but they were just everyday life. Now, today, with the way antiquities organizations are going in Egypt and in other places, as all of these countries that were occupied colonially and material have been taken away from them and put into museums, now have a much greater idea about their past and a much more important role in preserving their past than they had in the had previously.
With that, we come to the end of the available time. My Sincere thanks to Jim Phillips and Emily Teeter for joining us tonight. It's been a most interesting program for me, I will confess.